Greetings, I'm Sue, and today is April 8th, 2026, and this is the Taunton Daily Gazette for the Talking Information Center. First article, Missing Dog Reunited with Taunton Owner by Jansen McNair from the Enterprise and the USA Today Network. After a traumatic incident in March, an owner has been reunited with her lost dog. Naomi Nunez of Taunton was walking in Dorchester around Dudley Street on March 18th with her two dogs, Lexi and Biscuit, when she said she crossed paths with a man who kicked Biscuit into the road. They weren't barking, didn't even approach the guy, nothing, she told the Enterprise. As soon as Biscuit was going to pass his foot, the guy just picks his foot up and kicks him. We were in the middle of the sidewalk, she said. He launched Biscuit to where cars parked on the side of the road. Nunez said afterward Biscuit ran off into traffic and veered the direction of her mother's house, where they were staying at the time of the incident. I tried to run after him so fast, and when I got there, I couldn't find him, she said. I don't know what direction he went in. Nunez said she reported Biscuit missing to the police and posted online about it, and someone reached out to her about finding him days later. A woman called me and said, "Hey, I think I have your dog." She told me she was by the area where he was last seen, she said. She calls me instantly. She shows me him, and I started crying. I'm like, "That's Biscuit." Biscuit was missing for days, the owner said. Nunez said she once lost sight of Biscuit on the day of the incident. She returned to the scene where police had arrived. I went back to where the incident happened, and the guy that initially kicked him was being questioned by police, she said. The suspect told police he had kicked the dog, according to a police report from the incident, and that afterward he was attacked by five males that appeared to be in their 20s. The suspect was charged with animal cruelty. Nunez said she took Lexi with her to go meet Biscuit, and he was overjoyed to be reunited with his family. He was going crazy, she said. Happy to see his sister, happy to see me, just sniffing everything. She was sniffing him, playing with him like, "Wow, you're really here." After reuniting with Biscuit, Nunez says she took him to the vet to ensure that he was healthy and to determine whether he had any injuries. They did x-rays. No broken bones or fractured bones, which is great, she said. They just sent me home with certain foods and a little bit of medication because he did have, like, diarrhea coming back home, and the doctors think it was because he picked up something from the days that he was in the street. Nunez said it's a relief to have Biscuit back home safe. I feel so happy. I feel whole again, she said. Lexi wasn't eating, she wasn't using the bathroom, and she didn't want to do anything. She was really depressed. When we got him back, it was like, everything's back to normal, she added. These two were my first babies. I've had them since they were out of the litter together, and they've been inseparable ever since. Next article. Man sentenced to life in prison for Falmouth murder. The mother of Miltier Zavin Hendricks, 19, of Falmouth, said her son was the kindest, most gentle young man with so much more living to do. At the sentencing hearing Friday in Barnstable Superior Court of Adrian Black, convicted of killing Hendricks, his family told Judge Elaine L. Buckley how his death has devastated them. Miltier is loved deeply by everyone who knew him, and losing him has been devastating, said Nicole Sidney, speaking on behalf of Hendricks' mother, Rachel Lopez. We miss his smile and his sense of humor. Knowing you will spend the rest of your life in jail gives me some solace, but the pain you have caused us all is a true life sentence. Buckley told family members that there was nothing she could say to ease your pain on the death of a 19-year-old young man. I thank you so much for what you've told me about Milt. He was clearly a beloved member of your family, a son, a brother, a cousin, a godson, a grandchild. Your loss is tremendous, and there is nothing I can say that will make that any lighter, she said. It is my wish for you all that today's proceeding, the verdict yesterday, the sentencing today, will give you peace. Buckley sentenced Black to life in prison without parole, the state's mandatory sentence. On Thursday afternoon, a jury found Black guilty of first-degree murder, concluding that the killing was pre-planned and carried out with extreme atrocity. They deliberated for about 2 hours before reaching a verdict. Prosecutors say Black stabbed Hendricks, 19, twice around 4:45 p.m. on June 10, 2023, during a confrontation at the Gosnold Grove apartment complex. Black was 22 when arrested in 2023. Hendricks was taken by ambulance to Falmouth Hospital before being flown by helicopter to Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where he later died of his injuries, including a wound that penetrated his heart. The fight stemmed from insults that Hendricks directed at Black's friend, Armando Gomez. According to authorities, Gomez, who prosecutors say threw the first punch that day, is expected to be tried separately for the killing in June. Black did not initially know Hendricks. During his closing argument, Cape and Islands Assistant District Attorney Thomas Flanagan Jr. said that surveillance footage and cell phone videos show what began as a fistfight. He said Black can be seen on the periphery before he enters the altercation when Hendricks is distracted to stab him twice. This was not just a tragedy like a lightning strike or a natural disaster, said Flanagan. I suggest to you what the evidence shows in this case is that this defendant and Armando Gomez, what they did to Melchior Hendricks was a cold-blooded, planned, and deliberately premeditated murder, and nothing less than that. Multiple witnesses identified Black as the person seen in the footage wearing a dark-colored sweatshirt, said Flanagan. A cell phone video was also recovered at the scene that investigators traced back to Black, he said. Flanagan also pointed to Black's text messages, such as threats sent to Hendricks, as evidence of murderous intent and consciousness of guilt. In one message, Black wondered if he should cut his hair, which Flanagan argued showed concern about being identified. Black's defense attorney, John Geary, said the fight was fast-moving and hectic, saying that chaos and pandemonium reigned in the Gosnold Grove complex. He argued that the intent was for a fistfight and not a premeditated act of violence. During the trial, the slang term fade was defined as a physical fight. There is no premeditation for this. This was a fade, a fight. And then you saw what happened. It accelerated, said Geary. Geary highlighted the lack of forensic evidence linking Black to the crime, including no usable fingerprints recovered from key vehicles and potential weapons and tools in the car that were tested but not connected to the crime. He also reminded the jury that key witnesses testified after being granted immunity. Weigh the credibility of the people who testified before you. They came in to tell you the truth, and some of them did that under grant of immunity. You use your own common sense and your collective collaboration to determine what's credible, said Geary. Next article. Officers policing license suspended by Emma Rindlisbacher from the Taunton Daily Gazette. A Taunton man who works as a sergeant for the UMass Boston Police Department was charged in federal court in retaliation to a vendor kickback scheme, according to a copy of the indictment. Eduardo St. Ford was the chief operating officer of a vendor in Queens, New York, that provided security services for two New York City nonprofits that operated homeless shelters and home care services for the elderly and for individuals with medical needs. The specific nonprofits and vendors involved were not named in the indictment. However, the indictment alleges that St. Ford paid more than $75,000 in bribes and kickbacks to two other men who were also charged in the indictment. St. Ford was released on a $500,000 unsecured bond and was required to surrender three firearms, according to court documents. St. Ford was charged with three offenses, one count of federal program bribery, one count of violation of the Federal Travel Act, and one count of conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States. St. Ford, who lives in Taunton, works for the UMass Boston Police Department. On Thursday, April 2, 2026, the Peace Officer Standards and Trainings Commission suspended his license to practice as a police officer in Massachusetts, according to a copy of the suspension order, which cited evidence that St. Ford engaged or may have engaged in criminal conduct. A spokesperson for UMass Boston confirmed St. Ford works at the university but declined to comment further, according to reporting by WCVB-TV. Next article. Late power line project blocking reactor restart. Multiple power line projects that have been delayed for years could postpone the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant restart unless federal energy regulators grant waivers for the nuclear facility in Pennsylvania to connect to the grid speedily, plant owner Constellation Energy said in a recent filing. The U.S. power producer is working to restart a reactor at its Three Mile Island plant under the new name Crane Clean Energy Center by the end of 2027 under a contract to deliver electricity to the plant for use by Microsoft data centers. To connect to the grid, Crane will need approvals from the regional grid operator PJM Interconnection. Initial feedback from PJM said multiple transmission projects, some with in-service dates of December 2030, would need to be completed before Crane's more than 800 megawatts of electricity generating capacity can be delivered to the grid. Those projects include hundreds of miles of new 765 kilovolt and 500 kilovolt transmission lines as far away as West Virginia. Transmission lines, which carry electricity from power plants and can cross multiple states, are frequently delayed for years. If those projects remain contingent facilities in Crane's final interconnection agreement, Crane will not be considered fully deliverable, and its ability to provide capacity and energy will be at risk, at least until the end of 2030, Constellation said in its waiver request to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Next article, late season freeze hits Midwest, East Coast. New Kona storm heightens flood risk in Hawaii. Tens of millions of Americans awoke to temperatures that felt more like winter than spring on April 7th, and forecasters warned of another overnight freeze. Freeze warnings extended across states from the Midwest to the East Coast, including Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. Parts of Pennsylvania, northern New Jersey, New York, and New England even saw snow showers and flurries. Several areas remained under a freeze watch or warning into the morning of April 8th, the National Weather Service said. Temperatures were expected to drop as low as the 20s Fahrenheit, the Weather Service said. Cold conditions were forecast to persist through midweek, with daytime highs in major northeast cities, including Boston and New York City, remaining in the 40s through April 8th before rapid warming later in the week, AccuWeather reported. The outlet said the daytime highs in parts of the Midwest might not rise above the 30s. Meanwhile, unsettled weather was threatening slow-moving rain and storms in Florida and another Kona storm in Hawaii. A slow-moving storm system was driving lingering showers and thunderstorms over parts of Florida, helping ease an ongoing drought, but also bringing a risk of flash flooding and hazardous coastal conditions along the eastern part of the state through at least the middle of the week, forecasters said. The Atlantic coastline will be most at risk for heavy rain, with cities including Miami, Daytona Beach, Orlando, and Jacksonville in the targeted region, AccuWeather reported. Rainfall could total from 1 to 3 inches along the Atlantic coast and much of South Florida, with some localized areas receiving 4 to 6 inches, AccuWeather reported. In some extreme cases where repeated storms move and linger over the same areas, up to 12 inches could fall, the outlet said. Another Kona storm was threatening already battered Hawaii with more heavy rain and flood risks through the end of the week. A Kona storm, or a Kona low, is a major weather producer, according to the Weather Service. The word Kona refers to the side of the Hawaiian Islands that is usually sheltered from trade winds and rainfall, but a Kona storm, a type of seasonal subtropical cyclone, could bring torrential rainfall. This week's Kona storm was expected to bring strong winds, widespread heavy rainfall, and flooding risk to the state, the Weather Service said. The risk for mudslides was also elevated in areas already saturated by March's two destructive Kona storms. Showers and thunderstorms will increase from Tuesday night through Thursday, with the most significant impacts expected beginning Thursday night as deeper tropical moisture spreads across the islands, AccuWeather reported. Next article, Trump threats to Iran more hostile. Iran ramps up its own warnings before deadline. President Donald Trump, ahead of his April 7th deadline for Iran to make a deal, issued a stark warning that a wave of expected U.S. military attacks on critical infrastructure would leave the country unable to recover. A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will, Trump wrote in an April 7th social media post. The entire country can be taken out in one night, and that night might be tomorrow night, Trump told reporters at the White House on April 6th. Every bridge in Iran will be decimated by 12 o'clock tomorrow night. Every power plant in Iran will be out of business, burning, exploding, and never to be used again. Iran responded by declaring it would no longer hold back from hitting its Gulf neighbors' infrastructure and claimed to have carried out fresh strikes on a ship in the Gulf and Saudi industrial facilities linked to U.S. firms. Hours before Trump's deadline, Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said more than 14 million proud Iranians had registered to sacrifice their lives to defend Iran. I, too, have been, am, and will remain devoted to giving my life for Iran, he said in a post on X. Strikes on Iranian energy and transportation infrastructure would mark a major escalation in the conflict. Experts warn the attacks on civilian infrastructure could be war crimes and could turn Iranian civilians against the United States. Trump has brushed off those concerns. Trump on Easter Sunday renewed the ultimatum for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the waterway used to ship much of the world's oil. Since the United States and Israel launched the war on February 28th, Iran has blocked oil shipments through the strait to drive up global fuel costs. Early on April 7th, the average price of a gallon of gas across the United States has reached $4.14, according to AAA. Prices were considerably worse in some places. In California, the average price was $5.93. The average price at the start of the year was $2.82. The president left the door open to a possible 11th-hour deal with Iran to avoid an escalation, saying in his post that a group of officials the United States says it has been negotiating with privately are smarter and less radicalized than their predecessors. Vice President J.D. Vance, at a press conference in Budapest hours before the 8 p.m. deadline, said Iran faces a choice and can go down one of two pathways after the war. The first option is for Iran to be a normal country that does not fund terrorism. The second pathway is one in which its leaders don't come to the table and Tehran's economic situation further deteriorates. The nature of the conclusion is ultimately up to the Iranians, Vance said of the negotiations currently underway. Militarily, it frankly doesn't matter one way or the other to us. It's fundamentally a question of what does this look like afterwards, he added. As the clock ticked down on April 7th, strikes on Iran intensified throughout the day, hitting railway and road bridges, an airport, a petrochemical plant, and knocking out power lines, according to Iranian media. The United States also carried out multiple strikes on Karg Island, according to Reuters and the Wall Street Journal, citing officials. American forces in March carried out strikes on the island where Iran's main oil export terminal is located. Vance said the strikes on Karg Island do not represent a shift in strategy. We were going to strike some military targets on Karg Island, and I believe we have done so, Vance said. I don't think the news on Karg Island represents a change in strategy or represents any change from the President of the United States. Iran's Revolutionary Guards said in a statement that Tehran's response to the attacks on its infrastructure would deprive America and its allies in the region of oil and gas for years. America's regional partners should know that up to today, we have shown great restraint for the sake of good neighborliness and have said and have some consideration in choosing targets for retaliation, it said. But all of these considerations have since been removed. Trump abruptly called off similar threats against Iran's energy infrastructure over the past several weeks, citing what he has described as productive negotiations with figures in Iran whom he has never identified. Tehran has denied any such talks have taken place. Leading up to Trump's deadline, the two countries had exchanged proposals with Pakistan acting as the main go-between, but there has been no sign of compromise, with both sides claiming to have won the war and demanding concessions to end it. Iran's ambassador to Pakistan said on April 7th, positive and productive endeavors by Islamabad to mediate an end to the war were approaching a critical, sensitive stage, but gave no further details. A proposal conveyed by Pakistan called for a temporary ceasefire and the lifting of Iran's effective blockade of the strait, while putting off a broader peace settlement for further talks, according to a source familiar with the plan. But Iran's 10-point response, as reported by IRNA news agency on April 6, would require a permanent end to the war, the lifting of sanctions, and a promise of the reconstruction of Iranian sites damaged by the Israeli-U.S. strikes. It would also include a new mechanism to govern passage to the Strait of Hormuz. Next article, analysis. Tech giants pressured over conservation efforts. Amazon, Microsoft, and Alphabet's Google have each recently abandoned construction of multi-billion dollar data centers over community opposition, and now the companies are coming under shareholder pressure over the environmental impact of their projects. More than a dozen investors are cranking up the heat on companies ahead of annual shareholder meetings this spring, seeking more data on the tech giants' water usage and conservation efforts as they seek to expand their computing power, according to interviews with Reuters. Trillium Asset Management, a Boston-based firm with more than $4 billion in assets under management, filed a resolution with Alphabet in December, seeking clarity on how it will meet existing climate goals given the surging energy needs of its data centers, Andrea Ranger, director of shareholder advocacy, said in an interview. The company pledged in 2020 to halve its emissions and use of carbon-free energy resources by 2030. Yet Trillium said emissions instead rose 51%, leaving investors in the dark about how it planned to meet those goals. A similar resolution from Trillium last year won support from nearly a quarter of independent shareholders. Green Century Capital Management shareholder advocate Giovanni Eichner, meanwhile, said it was in discussions with NVIDIA about submitting a resolution to ensure that short-term AI gains do not come at the cost of long-term climate and financial risk, declining to share more details. Shareholders want more data on the company's water usage. North American data centers used more than 264 billion gallons of water in 2025, according to data from market research firm Mortar Intelligence, roughly equivalent to the annual demands of New York City. While Meta, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft have all started using closed-loop cooling in their data centers that require much less water, the data on that usage varies. Meta's 2025 environmental report showed water usage for the sites it owned, but not for the ones it leased or were under construction. Total usage rose 51% from 3,726 megaliters in 2020 to 5,637 megaliters in 2024, enough water to supply more than 13,000 homes for a year. Google's 2025 environmental report showed data for the sites it owns and leases, but not those operated by third parties. Microsoft reported total water usage, but not by site in its sustainability report. Amazon did not report total water usage data and instead provided data showing usage per unit of power in its 2025 sustainability report. Josh Wiseman, director of infra capacity delivery at Amazon, said it was increasingly disclosing site-specific water consumption data where we operate. An Amazon spokesman added the company was committed to being a good neighbor and was investing in efficiency efforts, bringing new energy online and reducing its water usage. Site-level data is crucial as it helps investors to better assess the operational risks and the performance of the company in managing them, investors said, adding that they also wanted to know more about the efforts to replenish the water supplies. We haven't seen them disclosing enough about their water consumption and the impact on the local community, said Jason Chi, lead technology analyst at Calvert Research and Management. a Microsoft spokesperson said environmental sustainability was a core value and it was proactively addressing sustainability and challenges and accelerating solutions for long-term impact. A Google spokesperson declined to comment, and Meta did not return a request for comment. Dan DiIorio, vice president of the Data Center Coalition, a lobby group whose members include the big four tech firms, said improving community engagement had become a top priority over the last year. Being upfront with them regarding energy and water use, and so that residents can understand that this project will not stress their resources and will protect them as ratepayers, is crucial. Next article, Artemis II completes historic flyby of the moon. The Artemis II astronauts are on their way home, leaving the moon in the rearview mirror after becoming the first humans in more than 50 years to travel near Earth's celestial neighbor, setting an all-time distance record and completing the most important leg of their historic mission. The test will pave the way for a possible 2028 moon landing. The Artemis II astronauts traveled farther from Earth than any humans ever have, 252,756 miles, according to NASA. The previous record was set in 1970 during the infamous Apollo 13 mission, which recorded a distance of 248,655 miles away. The Artemis II astronauts passed that milestone before 2 p.m. on April 6th, and then went thousands of miles farther, swooping around the far side of the moon. The Orion spacecraft came as close as 4,067 miles to the lunar surface. That altitude allowed the crew to see the full disk of our celestial neighbor as they witnessed lunar sights that no other humans, not even the Apollo astronauts, have experienced in person. During this seven-hour close approach, known as lunar flyby, the crew, astronauts Reid Wiseman, Christina Koch, Victor Glover of NASA, as well as Jeremy Hansen of the Canadian Space Agency, made observations of the moon's far side, which is permanently faced away from the Earth. They relayed these observations in real time to a global live stream. The crew also came up with two names for craters on the moon, the first in honor of their spacecraft integrity and the second in honor of Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died in 2020. To top off an incredible day of space travel, the Artemis II crew witnessed a sublime solar eclipse visible only to them and no one back on Earth. President Donald Trump called in as well, telling the crew that they inspired the entire world. "Humans have really never seen anything quite like what you're doing," Trump said in the 12-minute call. "It's really special. America is a frontier nation, and the four brave astronauts of Artemis II really are modern-day pioneers," the president continued, adding, "We're going all out. We'll plant our flag once again, and this time we're not just going to leave footprints." With all that happening on April 6th, it's no surprise that April 7th was scheduled to essentially be a day off. That's all the time we have for today. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the Taunton Daily Gazette on the Talking Information Center.